coming up on Philosophy Talk.
The Science of Love.
Science and pseudoscience.
Scorpio is the natural eighth sign, associated with the planet Pluto, is of the water element, has much to do with secrets, sex, the hidden parts of the body, and with subjects many consider occult or forbidden.
Astrology, numerology,
economics, linguistics,
creationism,
string theory. What's the difference?
Listen, Scorpio, your sign signifies power. It represents the ambition contained in all of us. This is about you, Scorpio.
Pseudoscience is a growl word. Science is a purr word.
Our guest is Stuart Vise from Connecticut College.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk, after the news.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW in San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Our topic today, science versus pseudoscience. Science is one of humankind's most consequential, most revered achievements. To call something scientific is to praise it, to honor it.
In contrast, to call something non-scientific or anti-scientific or pseudoscientific is to disparage it.
Now, because science gets the props, many pretenders want to get in on the act. Take astrology, creation science, or paranormal studies. Real science or pseudoscientific pretenders?
How do we decide? How do we separate the pretenders from the contenders? We'll take up that question in our first segment.
Many people fervently believe in those so-called pseudoscientists, John, but why? What makes the human mind so susceptible to pseudoscience, superstition, and other unscientific noise? That's our second question.
Then we'll close by asking whether we can or should eliminate superstition and pseudoscience from our lives.
John, I'm just a little bit worried that some people might be put off by the way we're setting up this episode.
Why, Ken?
Because, you know, I can imagine somebody thinking that the question of separating science from pseudoscience is really just a political question in disguise.
Well, there's a stereotype out there today that the Democrats love science because they're not in favor of teaching creationism but evolution. And the Republicans are the opposite, because they're in favor of teaching creation science. But those are stereotypes. I'm surprised that you can.
That's not what I mean at all, John. Those are stereotypes, but that's not what I mean by political.
Well, what do you mean?
Well, suppose some devotee of one of these so-called pseudoscientists were to ask, who are you guys? Who are you guys to say what counts as science and what counts as pseudoscience? What gives you the right?
Well, I'd say we're philosophers, Ken. It's part of our job to decide what's worthy of believing and what isn't worthy of believing. Science is worthy of belief because it's objective and rational and it depends on experiment. Pseudoscience isn't any of those things, and it's not worthy of belief.
But, you know, calling something scientific, maybe by doing that we're just expressing our approval of it. It's what we like. And by calling something pseudoscience, maybe we're just expressing our disapproval of it. And, you know, because you and I have tenure in an elite university, our approval or disapproval matters.
I hate to burst your bubble, Ken, but I don't think our approval or disapproval matters that much.
Well, I don't really mean you and me, literally. I mean the whole academic, scientific, industrial, military, governmental complex, of which you and I are admittedly insignificant part.
But there's more to science than being approved by the whatever you call it.
The academic, scientific, industrial, military, governmental complex.
That complex approves of certain things because they're worthy of approval, because they produce results. They're objective. The experiments are repeatable. The results are testable. Science deserves our approval, but pseudoscience deserves our disapproval.
Maybe you're right, John, but despite that, you know, many people really do believe in what you're calling pseudoscience. I mean, take creation science. It's a big deal. Its advocates challenge the whole way we teach biology and evolution. They're kind of revolutionaries in a way. I don't think they'd like being told that their revolution isn't worthy of being believed in.
Well, I'm sure they wouldn't like that, but, you know, some people are right, some people are wrong. They're wrong. What's worthy of asking is why. so many people persist in believing in things that make no sense or make no scientific sense, and why they fervently resist any pressure to give up those pseudoscientific beliefs.
Well, you know, that is an important question, John. And, you know, and to try and address that question and try to convince people to abandon their pseudoscientific beliefs or equip them not to fall prey to them in the first place, you'd really have to dig in and try to understand how and why such beliefs manage to get such a grip on our minds.
Well, you know, Ken, they're everywhere. Everywhere in our lives, in unusual places where you wouldn't expect them, in the political process. A roving philosophical reporter has looked into this. April Demboski files this report.
While analysts and pundits fill the airwaves with their explanations and predictions for the upcoming election, another group examines political events from a different perspective.
Look at the planetary alignments that are forming in the sky.
Spencer John is a political astrologer based in Mill Valley, California. This is the
dawning of the age. And you particularly look at the outer five planets, which show generational influences, and you look at their alignments to see what they form, and that will tell you what's going on in society in general.
John's analysis goes way beyond two-sentence newspaper horoscopes. Professional astrologers study birth charts, a complex map of where the 12 planets were in the 12 houses of the zodiac at the time of a person's birth.
Everything that's born has a birth chart, so the country has a birth chart too. We're born July 4, 1776, so our zodiac sign is Cancer. So you look at the planetary alignments within that chart, and then the people that might be important to the country, like the president or a presidential candidate, you can look at their birth charts as well to see what kind of planetary alignments are forming in their birth chart at the time of the election.
John picks up a manila folder off his coffee table and pulls out the birth chart he's drawn for Hillary Clinton.
Now, Hillary, of course, is a Scorpio. She has her sun in the fifth house, and that shows that she actually has a fair amount of self-confidence and creativity at her disposal. It's also aspecting other planets in the house of communication, Saturn, Pluto, and Mars, which say she's super, super smart. Now, the problem there, though, is that these planets in the third house, Mars, Pluto, and Saturn, form a right angle to her sun, which can mean that she goes a little bit too much according to the book. Barack Obama would be much more inspirational because he's a Leo, and he has that ninth house sun, which is that preacher messenger energy. And with his Jupiter and Saturn conjoined in the third house, you might say that he has the ability to bring everyone together.
When John looks at how the candidates' charts fare in comparison with the chart of the United States, it's a close call. But one Democrat seems a better match than the other.
One other factor is that with Barack Obama, his Venus, which is his planet of relationship, is in the same place as the Venus in the chart of the United States. What that basically means is that there's a love affair going on between these two people, the United States and Barack Obama.
John's interpretations of the candidates' birth charts are just interpretations. Astrology is not an exact science, though it used to be widely practiced by scientists.
All the great founding fathers of astronomy did astrology. Galileo and Copernicus and Kepler and Tycho Brahe.
Glenn Perry is a PhD in psychology and author of 5 books on astrology.
It wasn't until later, maybe by the 18th century, that astrology fell out of favor and began to be looked back at as the mad mother of astronomy. That's before then, they were very much one and the same.
Today, astrology doesn't have the same scientific street cred as before. But astrologers say that to judge it within the scientific model goes against the very nature of the practice.
Empirical research methods for astrology are very, very problematic. It'd be like trying to test an eagle's capacity for flight by putting it in a cage and throwing it off a cliff.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm April Demboski.
I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
Our guest today is Stuart Weiss. He's a psychology professor from Connecticut College. He's author of Believing in Magic, The Psychology of Superstition. Stuart, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Glad to be here.
Stuart, what first convinced you that what you call magical thinking was widespread enough for you to write a book about it?
Oh, there have been a number of national polls on belief in superstition, and you've probably seen many of them on paranormal beliefs. Something like slightly over half of Americans say that they are at least slightly superstitious. So it's quite common. You don't have to search for paranormal or superstitious belief these days.
Well, let me go back to a question that came up in April's piece and Ken also raised in our earlier conversation. Is there really an objective way to distinguish scientific thinking from superstitious or pseudoscientific thinking, or is it just that we call the stuff we don't like pseudoscientific?
Well, we do call the stuff we don't like pseudoscientific. It's definitely pejorative. But I think there is one core thing that distinguishes the two, and that is the use of scientific methodology to find actual cause and effect relationships. Scientific thinking, valuing evidence and experimentation, manipulation of variables to find out what in fact happens.
But people who believe in what you would call superstition and pseudoscientific things, a lot of it purports to be empirical. They make predictions about, who's going to win the election and why and all this sort of stuff. And those can either be borne out or not borne out by things that happen. So why isn't that an empirical, it's a risky method because, if you walk under a ladder, you could have 7 years of bad luck. Well, if you do it and you don't have, I don't know if that's really the one. If you do it and you don't have 7 years of bad luck, then you're falsified. So isn't that the mark of something that's scientific?
Well, it is empirical, I guess you could say, in the sense that you are doing something and looking to see what happens. But it's not really an experiment. There's no control group. We often take a medicine for a cold, or we might take some treatment, given to us for a cold. And if the cold goes away, we think it, it did it. But in fact, we don't know. It just happened afterwards. And that's what we know.
At the other end of the spectrum, there are things like string theory that really, or even Einstein's theory of relativity when he first introduced it, they really don't seem to admit of much in the way of experimental verification. Are those really science, or are they just kind of a religious hypothesis that scientists like to get themselves involved in?
Well, I think that's an interesting question. I think there's a lot of faith. It may, we hope, be faith in logic and scientific principles that sort of underscore the whole thing. But there are people who extend beyond science, beyond the data, and I think we have to be a little suspicious of that too. Oh.
I want to take you back one step. You talked about the prevalence of superstition and other forms of irrationality. Are Americans worse than other people around in the industrialized West? Are people in the industrialized West less superstitious than people in developing countries? I mean, what's it like around the world?
I think that, well, there's quite a bit of variability. I'm not an expert on folklore throughout the world, but there is some variability. I don't think anybody is immune to it. I mean, here we are in the most, what we would like to believe is the most technologically advanced society there is, and yet it's very widespread here. So I don't think anybody can be proud of their level of scientific thinking.
Okay, let me ask you another question about whether there are hard and fast distinctions. That's one of the things John was pressing on you, because he said the string theory, on the one hand, that's physics. That's the hallowed halls of physics. So it gets to be called scientific, although how empirical it isn't. Isn't clear. Right. But then you might think chemistry, physics, biology, those are real sciences. Astrology is a pseudoscience. What about economics? Sociology?
Well, interesting. I mean, you could also say the same about astronomy, but there are areas that are empirical. I would say that economists think that they're doing empirical work, but they can't control the variables. They can only observe what happens in certain situations and measure that. And so I think there's always a problem there if you really want to say something about cause and effect. We don't know
why gas prices are going up or down, or we don't know why certain things are happening unless we actually, you know, can manipulate variables and watch what happens.
Okay, well, we're going to dig into this some more in a little bit. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're discussing science versus pseudoscience with Stuart Weiss from Connecticut College.
We've been drawing some pretty invidious distinctions. Science, that's good. Pseudoscience, superstition, that's bad. In our next segment, we'll ask why superstition, pseudoscience, and the other forms of irrationality have such a grip on the human mind. Now, how about you? You have a belief system. Are we being unfair to your belief system, whatever it is? Astrology, numerology, phrenology, critical studies, English literature, philosophy, economics, one of the social sciences? Or maybe you just base your whole life on pure science. Share your thoughts with us. The number is 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917.
Exploring the dark, irrational, superstitious reaches of the human mind. Plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Will you really suffer if you believe in things you don't understand? Is superstition always bad, always irrational? Is science always good, always rational? And what's the difference anyway? I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. The toll-free number, 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest is Stuart Weiss, author of Believing in Magic, The Psychology of Superstition.
Stuart, I want to ask you about the believing part. Do people really, truly believe in things like magic, superstition, and astrology? Or do they just kind of pretend to believe, you know, kind of for the fun of it? What do you think?
I think that some believe wholeheartedly. That is definitely true. But there is also a group of people who sort of say, I know this is creepy and weird and it probably isn't true, but I just don't want to take a chance. This is something, for example, chain letters. When people get chain letters, they often say, oh my gosh, what am I going to do now? You know, do I do this or not? And there's a tendency to say, I know it's silly, but it's not going to be a big deal. I'll, you know, distribute the chain letter and be done with it.
Well, you know, there was there's a famous physicist. I think it was Niels Bohr, but I'm not sure. And he had a horseshoe over his lab. You know, horseshoes are signs of good luck. So one of his scientific friends noticed that and said, Niels, I mean, come on. Do you believe that horseshoes really bring good luck? And he said, no, of course, I don't believe in superstitions, silly superstitions like that. But the interesting thing is, it works whether you believe in it or not.
So some people really do believe. I mean, if you said nobody really believes this stuff, we wouldn't have a problem. But let's think about the people who really do believe in this kind of stuff. I want to venture a hypothesis for you and see what you think. I think belief in things like astrology, magic, miraculous cures and all that sort of stuff. You look at human culture, they're kind of universal among early human cultures. And that makes me think, well, you know what? Our minds are naturally prone to believe such things. And scientific rationality is a late cultural achievement. Scientific rationality is really hard. So no wonder people believe in superstition and stuff like that, because they're kind of designed to believe that. What do you think?
I agree completely. The psychology is in favor of believing in all manner of strange things, and science is hard, as you say. It has a whole different logic, and generally speaking, it has a language that's hard to adopt. So yes, I would agree.
So why are we like this? What explains why we're so prone to believe in superstition, magic, pseudoscientific explanations of cause and effect relations? Well, why are we like this?
Well, we do like order in our lives. We like to be able to live predictably. And there are many things that are important to us that have high stakes and yet are outside of our control. And so superstition in particular provides a way to deal with that, even if we know it can't really affect the outcome of what we're hoping for. It gives you a sense that you've done something that, you know, one more thing that will bring about.
Yeah, I must admit, maybe I'm just a lazy person as opposed to a superstitious person. But, you know, I could be drawn to superstitions that don't require much of the intellect. Like, I mean, it's fine with me if the world was created by a beneficent being, as long as I don't have to read a lot or it doesn't imply that, you know. But astrology, I mean, my goodness, these people spent, I mean, it's like a whole research project. I mean, they're being as careful in planning their day and looking things up in books and so forth. I mean, what's the point of believing in something that's supposed to make life easy and predictable if it requires so much work? You might as well just go ahead and get a master's in biology.
Well, I think that's the pseudoscientific part. It sort of shores up the authenticity or the proposed authenticity of this discipline, if you want to call it that, because it's complicated and ornate. And if it were just something that you could do off the cuff, somehow people wouldn't put as much stock in
it. Right. So we think in our culture, we think science is cool, and anything that's going to pretend to the throne of science has to at least imitate science, right? If it's going to be kind of socially respectable.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, my brother used to advocate flipism, which was whenever you have a major decision in life, flip a coin. Now, that's the kind of thing I could get behind. That would really simplify things. But you know, look it up in this big book and know who's in the house of
we
who.
Got it, John. That's ridiculous. You're a lazy superstitious guy or something like that. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about science versus pseudoscience with Stuart Weiss. We'd love to have you join our conversation. 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. And Lucia in Daly City's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Lucia.
Hi, thank you. I'm just curious if you think that religion is kind of an extension of pseudoscience, and if you think of the upswing of it is kind of related to, like, the uncertainty of what, you know, the society at large and what's going on, and if that's kind of what's happening now in this kind of last 10 years, huge revivalism of fundamentalism in that.
Good question, Lucia. Stuart, what do you think? Thanks for the call, Lucia.
Well, I think that religion is not quite a pseudoscience because it's not really trying to use the trappings of science, except in creationism. They seem to be trying to do that. I do think that it is aimed at the uncertainty of life, of course, and putting some kind of order on the world. As to why it's become much more popular in recent times, I think that's a more complicated question. I'm not sure. You know, the caller suggests that perhaps our lives are more uncertain now, and so there's a greater need for it. That could be true, but I think she's onto something, at least in terms of the response to disorder as part of the emphasis of religion.
Well, you know, generalizations about religion are a little hard because it's such a big phenomenon. Now, if you go back into the Middle Ages, you can say, well, in a way, science was developed as an extension of religion, at least in some people's minds. That is, the whole idea that the universe was orderly and we could look for explanations and it must be written in the language of some rational language like mathematics kind of comes out of this conception of it's all being caused by a rational, all-knowing God. So, and I think some religions now, you know, maybe you disapprove of their reasoning, but they see it as an extension of at least logic and rationality, if not the whole scientific method.
1-800-525-9917 or email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. John in Oakland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, John.
Delighted to be able to talk to you. I'd like to say that you're giving science a bad name here. I think, actually, you have a rather pseudo-scientific approach. You posit a bunch of straw men and then you knock them down one by one, such as the notions of what astrology is. You take the stupidest ideas and then you puff yourself up about what science, how great it's about the pursuit of truth. It's a methodology only. It's unable to reproduce all kinds of things. The attempt to try to understand reality using scientific method is silly.
Okay, John, I just want to clarify your point.
One other little thing about astrology. If you really want to know what it is about, you need to read Hamlet's Mill by von Däcken. It is not about predicting the future. It is about mythology. It is about an early attempt to understand reality using mnemonic devices. And it is so annoying to me to hear people, you know, use a
method. I look in my paper every morning.
Have you ever read Hamlet's Mill? Do you have any
Are you going to let me talk, John? John, come on now. Let me have a say here. I look in my paper every morning. I see what it says for Capricorn. And believe me, astrology is alive and well, and it's used to tell people what's likely to happen in their life. So don't blame us for misinterpreting astrology. Maybe blame all those people who are writing about astrology for misinterpreting a historical phenomenon.
Yeah, Stewart, what do you think? I mean, so we've got a determined advocate, practitioner. And that's why I was saying some of these things we would call pseudoscience, people really firmly, fervently believe them. What do you think is going on here?
Well, you know, it becomes important to their lives for certain reasons. I think there is also, beliefs are adopted for many reasons. It may not just be evidence, you know, which is what scientists value most, but it could be that there's sort of a sense of anti-establishment, you know, fervor that is attractive to them. You know, many pseudoscientific treatments for ailments have a certain holistic value to them that appeals to a certain kind of person. I think it's a complicated thing to take any individual person and say why they adopt a particular belief. So there's going to be multiple reasons.
So this goes back to the thing I was saying at the very top of the show. I mean, there is, even if it's not just a political question, there is a political dimension to this because we have this whole establishment. The scientific, sure, academic, governmental, military, industrial complex. I mean, it really is a real thing, and it's built on a certain kind of inquiry. I mean, it's kind of a seamless web between the scientific community and industry and the academy and all that. And we have political power, right? And we try to eliminate or discourage or disparage these other things. So there is a political dimension to this. But the question is, does the political dimension make it illegitimate? I mean, can we prove that we have more than political power on our side and we have, you know, the objective voice of reason on our side or something like that? What do you think about that?
I think there is a politics to it, I would argue that we're not as powerful in many cases as the opposing side. I think that there are many. One of the areas that I've looked into is the treatment of autism. This is like a magnet for fad treatments and therapies, and I think that in some ways the scientific approach is losing out because so many people are trying diets and afraid to take vaccines because they think vaccines cause autism, that the more reasoned approaches are losing. So, yes, of course, and we do have this authority that comes with being academics and so on. But it doesn't mean that the rest of the world really listens to us. I'm sorry to say. I think,
yeah, but you know, there's a lot of places. In other words, Descartes said, there's will and there's judgment, and he thought God gave you all the knowledge you needed to do the things you needed to decide. But most of us don't feel that way. We have an autistic kid, and we find out, well, science is working away on this. They don't have too much to say. There's no cure. Or have cancer. Right. People, there's a vacuum in your life that science can't fill. Now, I must admit, I don't see too much harm in fads as long as the science isn't there. When it is there, for example, take dieting. I think the science of dieting is pretty simple. Expend more calories than you take in and you'll lose weight. But in spite of that fairly simple truth, all kinds of fad and magical diets are always out there, and I guess they do harm.
And people believe in them. But we've got lots of callers on the line. David in Hayward. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, David.
Hey, thanks for having me on. It's my first time hearing the show. What a great show.
Well, thanks, David.
Good for you, David.
Well, and I was trying to decide whether to call, and then when the woman called in, I thought, okay, now I've got to call in and mention the Kabbalah, because she was asking about religion, and it kind of pulls everything together. See, according to the Kabbalah, reincarnation and astrology are fundamental aspects of reality. And one thing that I really like, there's a Kabbalah school on Robertson, it's a temple, and they teach classes there, and it's on Robertson, and the way they start every class, the rabbi would always say, first, don't believe me just because I've told you. Consider what I put forth, walk through life, see how reality manifests, and then you will see over the years, if your eyes and ears are open, you will see that what I suggest is true. But don't believe me. Consider it and walk through life.
Yeah.
That was back in 92. And now, as I do my best to keep my eyes and ears open.
David, that's very interesting. I'm a Madonna watcher, and I think her life, I think she's cheered up since she started believing the Kabbalah. So what do you think about that, Stuart?
Well, let me interject here. Thanks for the call, David. I think this is really important. I just want to stress something. One of the things that science, at least in some conceptions of science, does is make the universe dead and dull. Yoda says in Star Wars, I'm not made of this dumb, dull matter. I'm made of the Force, right? And the Force enlivens. And scientific rationality despiritualizes our existence. So, I mean, a reason to believe in all these things is it re-enlivens material existence. What? And maybe that's good. I don't know. Stuart, what do you think?
I think that's absolutely true. I think that scientists are seen as people who are kicking the crutches out from underneath other people and taking sort of the fun out of life. But I think that there is a way in which looking at the world scientifically can be beautiful and fun and stimulating in the same way. It's just not part of our culture. We have a culture of belief. You know, you're given credit for sort of going out of yourself and being surrendered to a belief. And unfortunately, scientists are much more reluctant to do that. So they are going to be viewed differently.
Leo in Los Altos on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Leo.
My question is about scientific method. If there's a difference between science and pseudoscience, and there certainly is, it's a question of method. How would Professor Rice or Professors Taylor and Perry describe the specific steps of scientific method?
So, Stuart, I'll throw that one to you. Thanks for the call, Leo.
Yes, I would say that it involves the manipulation of variables, meaning control groups versus experimental groups, and the elimination of alternative hypotheses. In other words, any particular thing that's happened, we have to try to think about what are the different causes for that outcome, and then try to one by one eliminate them by forming the right kind of experiment.
So why is this so hard, though? And why, I mean, you would think this would be the human gift. How did we get these complicated cultures and all that sort of stuff? Why didn't evolution make us kind of naturally suited to do science rather than to do religion, superstition, you know, rain dances and all that stuff?
I don't know. It's a little bit harder than just adopting a belief. We are actually very scientific in certain times and places. It's kind of a funny thing. If you're buying an expensive piece of equipment, a TV or a car, people are pretty scientific about how they evaluate it. They try it out. They make sure it does the right thing and so on. And that's very much what a scientist does. In the case of medical treatments that are a bit more mysterious or other areas of our lives, we tend to adopt things for other reasons, and that's where we break down.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing science versus pseudoscience with Stuart Weiss from Connecticut College.
We've been talking about why pseudoscience, superstition, and other forms of magical thinking have such a hold on the human mind. Is scientific rationality somehow unnatural? In our next segment, we'll ask whether it's possible to break that grip through education or re-education.
Reforming the human mind, when Philosophy Talk continues.
But what if I am superstitious? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Stuart Weiss, author of Believing in Magic, The Psychology of Superstition.
So, Ken and Stuart, we've got a bunch of emails. I'm not going to be able to get through all of them, but let me just mention three. To start with, Stephen Naylor points out that we're picking off the easy fruit when we talk about astrology, but there's real stuff like the whole issue about global warming. Is that involves pseudoscience or science? People as smart as Michael Crichton seem to think it's all pseudoscience, but is it? Stephen Upjohn asks about coincidences and the importance of coincidences in forming the mindset that leads to a belief in superstition and pseudoscience. And finally, Ron is a high school teacher who says, could we give him the most important way of distinguishing between science and science and pseudoscience to pass on to his students? What can he tell high school students about this important distinction?
Stuart, take any or all of those in whatever order you like.
Well, let's take the high school one first because it's going to have an effect on young minds. I think the difference between science and pseudoscience is that pseudoscience has the trappings, has the language. In some cases, it has sort of a basis in a speculative scientific theory, but it lacks the actual evidence. That's the clear distinction, is that no true evidence in the form of experiments, well-designed experiments, backs it up. It just, you know, all that wears a white lab coat is not science.
Nice phrase.
And so that's the distinction. Let's see. What about the others?
The other was
coincidences.
Coincidence. In your book, there's a lot about this.
Absolutely. No, coincidences. I mean, that is our sort of empirical selves, right? We're trying to find connections and figure out what causes things to happen. And of course, unfortunately, many things do happen by coincidence. You happen to be wearing a certain shirt and you get this really great job offer after an interview, and suddenly that's your lucky shirt, you know, and you wear it whenever you have a big event.
You mean that's a fallacy?
What's wrong with that?
What's wrong with that?
That's just being empirical.
Every time I do philosophy, look, I'm wearing my lucky sweater today, and we're getting hundreds of calls and dozens of emails. What's wrong with that?
Well, I'm going to surprise you and say that actually there's nothing wrong with it. I think that you should acknowledge that it's not true. But the fact is that wearing that shirt in the future might make you feel better on a psychological level, and I don't have any problem with that. I think that that many people would be much more sort of strict and say anything that smacks of superstition should be stamped out. I tend to think that if it's not causing any other problems and it makes you feel better to wear that shirt, go ahead and wear it.
Okay, but now how about going back to global warming? Now there's a case where there's a lot of disagreement about whether we're really being given science or pseudoscience, and at least there was 2 years ago. Now even George Bush seems to believe in global warming. What should an educated person look for when something like that comes up? Is the fact that the scientists really have a consensus all that convincing? Have there been cases in the past where there's been a consensus among scientists, but the outliers who really believe they were all wrong turned out to be right?
I'm sure there have been, and you know, even Darwin was probably in that position at one point, but I think that this is a tough one. I think it's a politically charged situation, and again, it's a situation where variables can't be manipulated. We're just making observations and counting after things happen, and so that's the problem there. But I do think, I mean, I saw Al Gore's movie. I think there's a lot of data there. I'm sure that it would be good to see a critique of it. But I think that it does have an inherent problem in that it's very charged politically, and also there's this issue of not, you know, of just making observations and not being in control and being able to do experiments.
Stuart, we have a caller who has a more general version of this question, I think. Alice in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Alice.
Thank you for letting me join your conversation. My question is that there seems to be a sort of, I don't know what you'd call it, an exclusionary process. I mean, for instance, there are people like Ian Stevenson who spent his whole life researching reincarnation, but applying the most rigid discipline, you know, scientific disciplinary measures to himself and to anyone who worked with him. I mean, as strict as anyone you would find in any lab. And he was basically just excluded from the club. I mean, nobody would take his findings seriously. You know, and yet, there are millions and millions of cases. I'm just using this as an example of reincarnation. We have more evidence, really, of reincarnation than we do, say, of black holes. But there are certain things that are considered outside the scientific bailiwick, and those disciplines are treated with contempt. And the irony is that there's no way of ever proving them if they're not admitted. At least some, you know, skepticism is fine, but utter scorn and rejection. They can't be studied scientifically because the people who follow them are de facto ruled as quacks.
Alice, thanks for the question. I mean, I think Alice is making a deep point. There's a certain kind of self-reproduction that goes on in any sort of institutional structure. Once science becomes institutionalized and powerful, it tries to reproduce itself. And things that try to challenge that establishment Well, it tries to prohibit. It's those challengers are trying to reproduce themselves too. But you know, the means of who controls the means of reproduction, as the Marxists might say, right? And maybe at bottom, that's all there is who controls the means of self-reproduction. What do you think about that? That at bottom, that's all there is.
I wouldn't go that far. I think that science has been pretty good at showing its usefulness as a way of thinking, and so that there is practical evidence of the you know, the value of this kind of logic and approach. Now, her issue with reincarnation, your comment on it, I think there is some truth to it. You know, that we are an establishment point of view, and there is perhaps, on part of some at least, a rejection of unusual ideas that is too severe. You know, I think that reincarnation, of course, has some problems in that how it works is not something that science can really work with. You know, that there is no known scientific mechanism. But the truth is that we've also discovered certain phenomena that were true before we knew the mechanism, and evolution is one of those. We didn't know, you know, Darwin didn't know about genetics. He just knew about this process that seemed to be happening.
I think that's a really insightful discussion, Stuart. I just want to add a little. Take two cases, the paranormal and reincarnation. Now, in the paranormal case, too, a lot of people have done careful experiments. They once had Uri Geller at SRI for a while, and they came up with some very startling results. He didn't bend any forks, but he was able to tell you where a car had gone, even though it where it ended up was utterly random. But I think it's exactly what you say. Scientists like to have a hypothesis that they're testing, a hypothesis that isn't just this happens, but here's how it happens.
Right.
And both with the paranormal and reincarnation, that's hard to come up with. I once asked the Dalai Lama why he believed he was reincarnated, because the Tibetan Buddhism claims to be a very scientific subject. And he said, well, there's forms of memory that kind of are in dimensions other than you guys in the West believe in. Well, if you really had that spelled out and had some other things happening along that dimension, then I think reincarnation theory would be taken very seriously, maybe.
More seriously, certainly.
More seriously.
But let me ask you a question as we're getting toward the bottom here. Is superstition, pseudoscience, maybe put religion in there, I don't know. Is that stuff with us to stay? Or will there be a day when scientific rationality has complete, let's call it hegemony, you know, over our minds? What do you think?
I think it's here to stay, and I don't think that's necessarily a good thing. I do think that the human need for explanation and also all these other forms of comfort that come with various beliefs that are not scientific, I think unfortunately those are going to always be there. There may be an improvement in the situation, but I don't think it'll ever completely go away.
So you think? I mean, is it pointless to try to have educational? We talked about reforming, re-educating the human mind. We kind of sounded a little like Maoist when we were talking that way. I thought, is there any point to try to educate people out of these things and reform the human mind out of these things, or is that just a hopeless endeavor?
Well, I don't think it's hopeless. I think it is, and I do think it's important, because there are people who are doing things that are dangerous. You know, I think that some of these medical treatments, especially if they're being used instead of conventional therapies, can be, you know, harmful, and we don't want that to happen. So I do think that it's important to do what we can in the way of education. I don't think we'll eliminate it from all areas of life, but I do think that it's important to do.
Well, it'd be nice if people at least knew when they were being pseudoscientific and superstitious. When I read the horoscopes in the morning to see what is going to happen to Capricorns, I don't take it seriously. But still, it's kind of fun.
Stuart, and then I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a real pleasure.
My pleasure, too. Thank you.
Our guest has been Stuart Vise. He's a professor of psychology at Connecticut College. He's author of, pertinent to this show, Believing in Magic, The Psychology of Superstition. But he also has a new book about kind of human irrationality. It's called Going Broke, Why Americans Can't Hold On to Their Money. So, John, what did you learn today?
Oh, I always learn a lot when we do philosophy talk, Ken. I mean, What do I learn in general? That's my question. I mean, it seems to me the problem with science, and I love science, it's great stuff, but science tells you more than you want to know about a lot of stuff and less than you want to know about a lot of other stuff. So there's kind of a gap there.
Oh, expand on that. I think that's a profound thought, but I'm not quite sure what you mean. Expand on
that. Well, I mean, science, I mean, I could learn all I want to know about nutrition. I mean, I could just, you know, read and go on the internet and so forth, but I know all I need to know about nutrition. My wife will tell me anything more I need to know. But now there's the question of, you know, the meaning of life. Now, what does science tell us about that? Well, not much, and mostly negative. So then what do I do about it? It seems to me, well, there's two different kinds of pseudoscience and superstition. There's one that's comforting but has no bad practical consequences. If I want to believe that the Big Bang was some supernatural being's way of getting the whole thing started, and I don't draw any implications about how I should treat my neighbor or anything like that, what's the harm?
Yeah.
On the other hand, if I believe that there's a big conspiracy out there to make me go to the doctor when I should be going to the local quack, that's bad.
Oh, yeah, I agree with you. You know, and I think it's really connected to something we touched on briefly. I just, you know, science is disenchanting in some ways about human life. It overturns one life-sustaining mythology after another in its mm-hmm. history. But life needs some enchantment. So here's the challenge. How can we have both the rationalistic disenchanting power of science and have things that re-enchant, right? And you were telling a way in which we kind of could have it both ways, right? The thing is, don't let your enchanting stories make you do things that are crazy. But if they're harmless, if your enchanting stories are harmless and re-enchant your life, well, that's a good thing.
And I must say, with astrologists, you know, I can really see why for thousands of years people thought that makes sense. It's hard to sit there and look at the starry heavens and not think it has some meaning.
Yeah, there you go. But, you know, for the final word on this topic, we turn to the debunker of all things scientific and pseudoscientific. That's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, not being a scientist, it is hard for me sometimes to figure out what science is real and what's junk. This is especially true in the ongoing discussion about global warming. Statistics fly everywhere with opponents of global warming theory accusing proponents of manipulating data to reinforce an ideology, and proponents of global warming theory accusing opponents of manipulating data to reinforce an ideology. Just for one example, a government study warning that polar bears might be extinct within 50 years was embraced by environmentalists, but was quickly countered by other studies saying the polar bear populations were actually increasing. Who to believe? I don't know. To discover the truth would mean wading through pages of data, graphs, pie charts, statistics, and spreadsheets. I'd rather eat a polar bear, frankly, which scientists all agree is not tasty. But there is a trope going around these days that really grinds my chaps. I have called a small sample from the internet and various newspapers. Have a listen. In 2006 alone, Quad Graphics prevented the emission of 11,878 tons of carbon dioxide, the equivalent of taking 2,332 passenger cars off the road. If every house in Canada exchanged just one incandescent bulb for a compact fluorescent, the savings in greenhouse gas emissions would be equivalent to taking 66,000 cars off the road. The Housing Corporation has spent around $90 million in energy retrofits, the equivalent of taking about 10,000 cars off the road every year. Mr. Bowden said the compost industry turned more than 555,000 tons of organic material into compost, the equivalent of taking 45,000 cars off the road a year. This changeover is projected to cut Ann Arbor's public lighting energy use in half and reduce carbon dioxide emissions by 2,425 tons annually. This is reportedly equivalent to taking 400 cars off the road for a year. By implementing these standards, California will be eliminating greenhouse gases equivalent to taking 6.5 million cars off the road by the year 2020. And further, if every state were allowed to enact these standards, greenhouse gas emissions would be the equivalent of taking 22 million cars off the road. Now, these are just some examples among hundreds. I can't speak to the science of it or the math, but I think it is pretty incontrovertible that admirable as these eco measures may be, no actual cars have been taken off the road for any time at all. In other words, if you want to take 200 cars off the road, say, for a year, the way to do it is to take 200 cars off the road for a year. I gotta go. Beep, 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 yeah. Beep, 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 yeah. Beep, 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 yeah.
Beep, 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 yeah.
Ian Scholes, the only man who can solve a philosophical problem in 60 seconds.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2008.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Daniel Elstein is our director of research. Lael Weiss is our webmaster. Also thanks to Zoe Corneli, Merle Kessler, Corey Goldman, and Mark Stone.
Philosophy Talk is sponsored in part by Powell City of Books, on the web at powells.com. Support also comes from the Templeton Foundation.
And from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.